Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Monday, October 7th. I'm Lauren Schmidt reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, forward progress stopped on wood fire, Chinook salmon spotted in Klamath River near former Iron Gate Dam for the first time in 100 years, and county conversations with Humboldt's 5th District Supervisor. Stay tuned, news on those stories and more coming right up. The forward progress on the wood fire burning outside of Redway in the Woods Ranch neighborhood has been stopped. To learn more about this near miss for the local community, we checked in with a firefighter on the ground.
So my name is Jordan Kilberry. I'm a fire captain specialist with Cal Fire. Just before 8 p.m. last night, Cal Fire Emergency Command Center, Humboldt Del Norte unit, dispatch got a report of vegetation fire in the area of Wood Ranch Road in the Redway. And then the first arriving unit that's seen gave a report of a couple acres and the heavy timber burning. And it was originally, that got bumped up to 50 acres. And then with more consistent and accurate mapping from the intel flight that was overhead, they mapped it at around 25 acres. Currently, there is control line around the whole fire, and there's crews actively out there today, and they'll be out there for the next few days mopping up and making sure it's completely out. Current containment on it is 25%. The cause is under investigation.
Although the fire was just outside of Redway, it could be seen from Salmon Creek, Bryceland, and Blocksburg, which sparked elevated concern. The fire captain explained that fires often look worse at night than they do during the day.
Yeah, obviously fires can tend to put off larger glow, and it's harder to determine size during the night because you can't see the whole fire. And with especially in that area, it's not flat terrain. It's in the mountains, in the hillside. That's why we have utilized all different resources like night flights with aircraft, GPS, cameras, different technology like that to get a better idea of how big the fire is.
The wood fire, true to its name, was burning in heavy timber, which posed additional challenges for firefighters.
It was definitely challenging because, when you get fires that are in the timber, that is challenging. And the terrain, typically the timber isn't in flat country, so it's that just makes it a little bit more challenging. We utilize aircraft if we need to, and our bulldozers, like our heavy equipment, a little bit more in areas like that.
Cal Fire has responded to the Wood Ranch area multiple times this year, so we asked if any of the fire activity has been related.
Not that I know of currently.
With peak fire season upon us, he urges everyone to ensure that their gates can be easily opened during an emergency and that their home address is clearly marked.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. It makes it easier for the first responders and firefighters to be able to access that property and to be able to reference that for other incoming resources that are coming to the scene so everybody can get there quicker and put the fire out quicker.
He also noted that Cal Fire's burn ban remains in effect until the North Coast receives a substantial amount of rain.
Be very mindful. We're not out of the woods as far as the fire danger. It is getting towards the end of the year. We haven't gotten much precipitation yet, and we're waiting on it. And then once we start to get precipitation and upper echelon of our department confers and talks about when it would be a good time to release the burn ban, and when it's safe to do so, we'll put out bulletins for the general public to be aware of the burn ban being released. Basically, just be fire safe and the normal stuff that you would do to prevent wildfires from happening.
crews will remain on scene of the wood fire throughout the week to ensure it doesn't breach their control lines. Local residents are asked to use caution as large fire apparatus navigate the one-lane road. KMA News also spoke with a family who lives on Wood Ranch, Spencer and Courtney Sweet, who were unable to obtain fire insurance due to the ongoing crisis. So they decided to invest in defensible space and other safety measures.
My immediate thought was that's why we've been doing all this prep, fire prep and clearing the roads and access and putting up signs and making sure that our property is tight and right and ready for fire and fire personnel to come through and do what they need to do.
You know, homeowners insurance is so expensive and really hard to get when you live entirely off grid. And the advice was to spend that money that you'd spend on insurance on preparing your property by clearing and having water storage and putting in the right water lines and tanks and using your money that way.
Spencer encourages all of his neighbors to install green reflective road signs because without them, firefighters have previously gotten lost while responding to fires in the area.
The trucks had to make a couple of turnarounds. They made a couple of wrong turns getting up there. And road signs, you know, there's been a little big push locally for all of our rural communities to get proper signage. And I feel like our ranch is one of the last ones to kind of address that.
He explained that because of their preparedness efforts, they felt some relief during this year's fire season.
You know, metal fire-resistant siding, all the brushing and clearing and getting the turnarounds opened up, that kind of thing, getting the fire line. We had our 2-inch fire line there prepped and ready, so the fire truck could pull right up, hook up, and fill their tender. You got to have the proper fittings and threads for those fire attachments, so they're not going to hook up to a 3/4 valve or anything like that. So yeah, it's important to have an 1.5-inch fire riser with proper valves and attachment points so that they don't have to be searching for adapters and whatnot. Have it accessible, you know, not blocked.
Concluding, he shared his takeaways.
Just stay diligent, really. Keep doing the prep work in the winter and just make sure your road's good and just have a plan.
For other community members looking for helpful tips, you can contact your local volunteer fire department or CAL FIRE, who offers free inspections. More information is also available online at readyforwildfire.org. The final barrier on the Klamath River was removed last weekend, marking a major milestone in the largest dam removal project in U.S. history. The removal opens over 400 miles of habitat for salmonid species, which the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration says is equivalent to the distance from Maine to New Jersey. For decades, 4 major dams blocked fish passage, significantly impacting local fisheries and tribal nations. NOAA Fisheries led efforts to safeguard water quality, and partners worked to remove sediment that had built up behind the dams to ensure it wouldn't harm the fish when the water flowed freely again. In a historic moment, the first salmon in more than a century is believed to have swum upstream in the newly freed Klamath River. Last Thursday, California Trout's sonar camera captured footage of what is likely a Chinook salmon migrating past the site of the former Iron Gate Dam near the California-Oregon border. This fish, measuring around 2.5 feet long, is part of the fall salmon run, the first and largest migration expected to benefit from the dam removal. Scientists say this event marks the beginning of the Klamath River's recovery. For over 100 years, these dams blocked salmon from reaching hundreds of miles upstream spawning grounds, contributing to the decline of California's iconic fish population. The $500 million project aims to restore that migration and revive the river's ecosystem. A coalition of nonprofits, tribal nations, and state and federal scientists are monitoring fish movement in the area. While this initial success is promising, experts caution that it could take years, even decades, for salmon to fully repopulate the upper reaches of the water. KMA News will continue to share updates. KMA News has been conducting monthly check-ins with Humboldt County supervisors, providing our listeners with up-to-date information directly from their elected representatives. Tonight's check-in features Humboldt County's 5th District Supervisor, Steve Madrone. Representing the unincorporated areas from Fieldbrook and Willow Creek to Trinidad, Hoopa to Orleans, and McKinleyville to Oreck. Good afternoon, Supervisor Madrone. A lot to cover, so let's jump right in. You have been a strong advocate for healthcare, particularly in support of St. Joseph staff in the past. Recently, there was a troubling story about a local woman who needed an emergency abortion, but was denied at St. Joseph, given a bucket and towels, and only then transferred to Mad River. With the closure of Mad River's birthing center and Soham Health deciding not to open an L&D unit, many pregnant individuals are now fearful of going to St. Joseph. What does the future of birth services in Humboldt County look like? And is this something the Board of Supervisors can address?
Well, I'm working on an agenda item to bring before our board in late October, hopefully, to have a discussion with St. Joe's, Mad River, Granada, which is supposedly going to take over the acute rehab unit care for the county, and there's been concerns there, as well as, you know, the union at St. Joe's. I've been meeting with the union. I've been meeting with the administration there. I will say that I know all the community, have a lot of concerns about where healthcare is going in Humboldt County, from a lot of different perspectives. So my hope is that we can bring these entities together to make some presentations before our board and have a lively discussion amongst the board and amongst the community where they can express their concerns. Hopefully we can get some of our questions answered, but it is a huge deal. And for a long time, as you know, we've been seeing a decline of specialists in the county. So, you know, a lot of people are traveling to the Bay Area and all kinds of other places to get their specialty care. And then birthing centers close. I will say that me and my sweetheart were part of helping to develop the birthing center at Mad River Hospital some 35, 40 years ago. And it is sad to see those things change. So it's time to have a broader community discussion about what's going on and how we as a community can, support good things for our healthcare workers, as well as for our facilities to be, supported in the ways they need to. So it's an important discussion. I look forward to having that before our board here later in the month.
And we will continue to follow that here at KMUD News. I want to pivot to the Yeehaw community, which is in your district and has received numerous abatements due to broken down cars and homes not up to code. At the recent supervisors meeting, you mentioned that progress has been made and that the community deserved another inspection, which I understand just took place last week, and you attended. Can you provide an update?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you know, I don't represent Yeehaw. I represent the county. But I'll just flash back real quickly to the late 1970s when the county was red tagging homes all over Southern Humboldt. All these back to the landers had come up to our community and were building what they could afford to build. And that included, scraps of plywood and tarps and whatever we could do. And so we pushed back on that. That was when the group called United Stand was created. Some of the members of that, Peter Childs and other people, are still around the community. And bottom line is that we pushed back. I think Supervisor Roger Redoni was quoted in and around that time of saying, we don't bulldoze homes in Humboldt County, even if they're built with alternative methods. The outcome of that was alternative owner building permits, where you're allowed to use alternative resources for siding and other kinds of things. You still need to meet structural components, electrical, and sewage and other kinds of building code issues. But, there's a lot of alternatives for building homes that are a lot more affordable than a $60,000 tiny home or, nowadays you're building a couple hundred thousand dollar duplexes. These things are costing people $800 to $1,200 a month. And there's a lot of people in our communities that can't afford more than a couple hundred dollars a month. And yeah, there are lists you can get on to provide some housing assistance and all these different things, but you can sit on that list for a year or two before you get any care. So the bottom line is that Yeehaw has been there a long time, and the owner, Charles Garth, has tried to provide an alternative for people to live in a community, and they are a community. I've been there many times. They work hard to support each other. There are no serious drug issues. People talk about how their mental health improved as compared to being out on the streets, where it's a pretty gnarly place, right? And he does not charge significant rent. Sometimes it's free, sometimes it's $100, $200, but it's a small amount of money. So he's not making money off these people. So that's important to understand. But yeah, there are some issues. The inspection showed that significant progress has occurred. A number of abandoned vehicles have been removed. The property as a whole has been cleaned up of debris, and that is piled in trailers that are ready to go to the salvage yard or to the dump. That's the next step, is to move that on. There were some control concerns about a property boundary on the north side with a neighbor. That's being resolved. And I have encouraged them to map out their entire village. That's what it is, a village, as well as identify each of the cars, mobile homes, and housing, elements that they have, and then put together a spreadsheet with what do we need to do with this one? Okay, the abandoned car needs to be removed. Did it get removed? When? What date? So helping them develop a checklist and a comprehensive approach to trying to deal with the issue. So it's really clear to the residents as well as the county what needs to be done, what has been done, what still needs to be done. Bottom line is it's safer there than it is out on the streets. Absolutely, significantly safer. Are there things that need to be done? Yes. And they're working at it. And I know the county staff are very, willing to try and continue to work with them. But there's a limit to that. And it's been going on a long time. So I'm hoping everybody will pick up the pace and do what's necessary to do all the cleaning up and that we need, and to deal with various safety issues that need to be also taken care of. So I'm seeing progress. I hope it continues.
Does Yeehaw have a realistic path to compliance? And what happens if they do or don't meet the requirements?
So it's a 39-week process that the planning department put before the board last week to go from where we're at now to complete abatement. So between now and then, first there was an inspection to get up to speed with where we're at right now, developing the comprehensive list of what needs to be done. The county's doing that from their end, from their perspective. The residents are doing that as well, so that they have a good handle on what needs to be done with each of the issues, be it an abandoned car, electrical issues, or whatever it might be. So that needs to pick up pace, as I said, and move forward rapidly. And if that progress can be made, then there is some chance that the board might consider. Of course, I can't speak for the board, but they were given a deadline of the end of the year to come before the board for a petition to rezone the property to something like multifamily village type settings, emergency housing ordinance conditions like we just passed in the last month or two. So there's now a lot of hope on the part of the people that live in the village that they'll get enough progress done to where they can show the board they're serious about, improving the various issues around health and safety, and that then ultimately they might be supported to petition for a zoning change that would allow for these things. Additionally, we need a new ordinance that allows people to legally be able to camp in tents and yurts and buses and other structures like RVs, et cetera. So we got a lot of things to work on, and I see progress on that. I hope we can really try and work this all out because, we can create all the ordinances we want, but the county isn't necessarily creating this housing or these sanctioned camps or other things. So when private landowners are stepping up and being willing to partner with us as a county and provide places for, in this case, 30 people to not be out on the streets, we need to do everything we can to work with them rather than against them. So, and I just want to say, I think staff have a lot of empathy and they're working hard to try and work with them. So I appreciate that as well.
Running out of time here, I want to end with some good news as the last barrier was finally removed from the Klamath River this past weekend, the final step in reopening more than 400 miles of habitat to salmon, steelhead, and lamprey. And today, Caltrout publicly announced the sighting of a Chinook salmon migrating up the river. Your thoughts?
Well, it was a wonderful celebration up in Yreka. I think there was about 500 people there. It was led by tribes, both downriver, midriver, and upriver. And yes, fresh Chinook salmon have been spotted now above the highest dam. So they're coming home. The river's currently running a little muddy after removing the coffer dams and the work that got done, but that will clean up and the fish are coming home. It's the most monumental dam removal project in the United States ever. But now we've got to refocus our efforts on the upriver areas and the dysfunction of what's going on in the wetlands and the headwaters, and work with the landowners, work with the agencies, work with the tribes to finish this effort on the Klamath River. So yeah, the fish are coming home. First time in over 100 years. Very exciting.
And Supervisor Madrone, we are out of time, but is there anything else you would like to share?
Well, I always appreciate KMUD for what it does. Tomorrow, our meeting. We have a very small agenda tomorrow, and then we have a week off, and then we'll be back at it. But thank you, KMUD listeners, for all the support you provide for this great radio station. It's our community link. Thank you, Lauren.
Thank you again for joining us here on KMUD. That was Humboldt County's 5th District Supervisor, Steve Madrone. You can catch our county conversations with Madrone on the first Monday of each month.
Mendocino County Clerk Recorder, Registrar of Voters, and Assessor Katrina Bartlame reported to the Board of Supervisors last week that the Assessor's Office has discovered an additional $5 million in assessed value. Her report is a response to public concerns dating back several years now that properties whose value was artificially repressed by Prop 13 were not being reassessed in response to improvements or to a change in ownership, as the law requires.
We now have three real property appraiser techs, and they have been going throughout the county and randomly picking areas within the county to look at GIS to make sure we have the structures on that property being assessed. So, and the reason they do that is so they don't bog down just the coast for that appraiser. They don't bog down just the Willits area for that appraiser. So they're randomly doing that. In August, our techs reviewed 1,087 parcels, which brought our total parcels reviewed to 3,706. They sent out an additional 29 discovery letters. We have 33 additional assessments pending. We discovered 8 structures that weren't being assessed properly, mainly sheds, miscellaneous improvements, which are pools, porch covers, etc., bringing an assessed value to the tax roll, and that's just an assessed value, of about $289,000. In August, our techs viewed an additional 378 properties, with 26 discover letters sent out. Most discoveries were the miscellaneous improvements of small storage sheds, carports, and decks, although they did find 2 single-family residences, some cabins, and a shop that totaled an assessed value of $703,000 in assessed value. This brings our discoveries up to just under $5 million in assessed value. So that's pretty cool.
Adam Gaska, a Redwood Valley resident who initially raised concerns, said Bartlame's report appears to be a step in the right direction, but that residents are still missing the context of how many properties need to be reassessed.
But I've never heard, I'm kind of a numbers person, and so I've never been told or heard, we're this behind. We have X amount of people that are in the queue that we're just behind and that we're actually making progress. This is a normal number of sales that we have to update and reassess people's property tax.
The property tax issue came to Gasca's attention when he noticed that some cannabis farmers had purchased land for just $500 an acre, far below market value, and that the assessment hadn't changed.
This happened enough, you know, hundreds of acres, at least the small number of people that I looked at first I thought something shady was happening. Somebody might be intentionally looking the other way for some people to not update the valuation of the property. And so, but then I started looking at like MLS listings and just other transactions that had nothing to do with cannabis, homes, ranches, winery, whatever. I noticed basically the same thing, that their property valuation was not getting updated, in some cases like 5 years, 6 years. And I do know that, you know, after 4 years, the property tax falls off. The county can only go to get 4 years back. So, you buy a house and, you know, they don't give you a supplemental, they don't reassess, and you go 6-7 years, they can only get you for 4 years of the new assessment, and they just have lost that money. It's fallen off the table, never to be recouped. And which wasn't, I don't know if it was better or worse. I mean, like, well, okay, like, it doesn't look like anybody's intentionally looking the other way. I think this is a systemic problem, but in terms of the money that's not being collected, it's worse. You know, this is like the number one place where the county gets general fund dollars. And I talked to two supervisors and I told them as such, and was like, you know, you should probably go figure out what's happening.
Adam Gasca is not an investigative reporter, and though he tried, he was not able to get to the bottom of the questionable assessments. 3 years later, it's still not clear what happened. There is an amnesty program, however, that's in place until November to encourage people who are out of compliance to come forward. They'll be reassessed, but they won't have to pay any penalties. For the KZYX News, I'm Elise Cox.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Javier Rodriguez. And thanks to our reporter, Elise Cox. KMUD News is online. You can find us on KMUD.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605. Or send us an email to news@kma.org. Reporting from our studio in Redway, I'm Lauren Schmidt.